You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. Karen Young, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Karen, you're the founder of WeShave. WeShave is a brand of shaving products for women. Is that right? How do you describe it?
Yeah. So we kind of call it a modern shaving experience that's created for women by women. And, you know, that encompasses not only our razor, but the skincare and grooming products as well.
Yeah. Give a little bit of an outline of how you got started and the products that you sell today.
Yeah. So I actually have a background in design and sort of sales and marketing. And I started many moons ago. I'm not going to tell you how long ago. But, you know, when I graduated college, I ended up going into the fashion industry. And I worked for some really high-end brands at the time. I guess still so. Dolce & Gabbana, Gianfranco Ferré, Roberto Cavalli, real, like, beautifully done, impeccably tailored Italian brands.
Wait, when you say design, what do you mean in this context? Designing the graphic design, the clothing, what exactly were you doing?
Well, I actually, when I started, I was in sales. And then I kind of got the design bug sort of took me a little bit and the entrepreneurial bug hit as well. And I ended up taking that sense of tailoring and pattern and all of that that I found through, you know, working with these Italian brands. And I moved into designing my own collection of home goods. That was my first entrepreneurial and design experience. But when I worked with those brands, I was what they called an account executive. So I was responsible for building them stateside by collaborating with retailers. So, you know, we worked with Saks Fifth Avenue and Nordstrom's and Neiman Marcus and so on.
Gotcha. And so how did that, tell me a little bit about that first business. That was Hammocks and Tea, is that right?
Hammocks and High Tea. Yeah. You guys did do your research. That's great.
We try.
So that was when I was working in fashion as an account executive, there were a lot of changes that I saw happening. The very first was with the economy. You know, we were at one point selling clothing that no one blinked, you know, and it was like $1,000 coat or things like that. We literally would like get clothing onto the floor and it would sell out in weeks. It was really an incredible thing to see how people were embracing fashion and seemed to have the means to spend on it. But then I certainly saw, you know, the change as we were moving, not only what was happening with the economy around like 2008, but also what was happening in terms of the shift that was about to happen with how people purchased clothing, moving from, you know, more interactions with retailers and actually going into a store to buy something into what we know now, which is, you know, you order something and in 2 days it's there. It's completely different experience. And I kind of was right in the middle of that wave as it was happening. And the way that I saw to ride the wave was to build my own brand and to actually sort of scratch at that entrepreneurial itch that was happening for me at the time.
And so with Hammocks and High Tea, that started off as a crowdfunding campaign, or what was the evolution of that project?
At that time, what I did was I took what I knew, which was I knew how to sell. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to set up a website, you know, I'll kind of like, I was like, literally, this was the language that I was like, I'm going to set up a website and see how that works. And, you know, I'm going to reach out to some blogs and I'm going to try and get some attention around it. But I also, you know, I still had that experience of building relationships with retailers, like understanding how to build a wholesale business. And so I literally sort of tried to work those two components together as I single-handedly, you know, got a sense of like how the industry was changing and how I wanted to be an entrepreneur and sort of bring together this sense of branding and incredible design and pair it all into a new experience. I found like a really wonderful manufacturer in New York, and we just started making pillows. And I started designing, and I pulled a little bit of my personal history in. And that was the whole like essence of Hammocks and High Tea. It was, you know, to say that my background was very, and my upbringing was incredibly colorful and really beautiful and very elevated in its own ways. My family's from Guyana, South America. So we had this incredible aesthetic that combined casual Caribbean with, you know, like the cobblestone streets and very, you know, high tea and that sort of thing. So, you know, there's nothing like that out there. And home design is really, really boring. Everything is like beige and white and sort of square. And I kind of cobbled all of that together into a small brand and launched that online. And of course, we had retailers as well.
Yeah, it's funny because I think right around that time that you were starting that, me and my co-founder, Jesse, were just wrapping up selling pillows on our side. That's one of the first things that we did with our first business.
Wait, you guys were the ink company, right?
Yeah. Yes. We made an ink and used those to print all kinds of products, including pillows and other kinds of furniture.
That's so funny. I actually remember it coming across that too.
Yeah. So, you know, I think a lot of the entrepreneurs that we've talked to on the show have had an experience like that where, you know, you have your first business, you learn a lot about getting something off the ground, working with retailers, you know, finding ways to sell your product, designing a product, and then the transition is always a little bit different, but eventually maybe you find a better idea or something that you're more excited about, or the pitfalls of the first thing that you built become glaringly obvious and you're like, you know, maybe I'm not as interested in this as this other idea. Like, what was that transition for you? And what was it that you learned from that first experience that took you into WeShave?
Yeah. So I think what I learned was that I knew how to build a brand, and I knew how to pull up those different components together. Because of that, I had that sales background. I also knew how to think about a product, not just from the sort of start of it or the idea, but also think it all the way through to when a customer actually experiences it. So some of the things that I took from fashion was like this sense of feel, you know, texture, how a fabric feels in your hand, tailoring, how something wears over time. And those were all things that I just kind of moved through and I think, you know, culminated in WeShave.
Can you tell me a little bit about the product line as it stands today? So you have this really beautiful safety razor. You have built out a line of lotions. Like, explain how that came to be and where you started with building out the WeShave product line.
Yeah. So I ended up after I closed Hammocks and High Tea, I ended up actually moving into luxury beauty, and I ended up working for Estee Lauder. And it was really funny. The reason I actually got the position at Estee Lauder was because my director was familiar with Hammocks and High Tea. And at that time, we had had some wonderful distribution. We were in Henri Bendel's. We were in all these stores across the globe. And she had seen us in Bendel's, and she's just like, you know, this is amazing. There's a particular division of Estee Lauder that handles all of the packaging for a few of the larger Estee Lauder brands. And she's like, I would love to have an entrepreneur in there, just kind of pulling all of our graphic designers together and helping us funnel this packaging, you know, and send this packaging out the door. And I was just like, oh, you know, that actually sounds really cool. You know, I love beauty. And I definitely had the sort of chops that she was looking for that position. And so while I was there, this is the problem with hiring entrepreneurs, right? Of course, while I was there, I noticed that there was a hole in the market for women's shaving. Not only was there a hole, but there was also like, there was nothing that was sort of being really well executed in terms of the type of product, in terms of a product that actually truly catered to women and our experience. I had the opportunity to kind of say, oh, let me just do a more modern version of a Gillette. And that just didn't feel like it was enough. I kind of just started looking up the history of shaving and razors and so on. There was something really interesting that was bothering me the most about it. Something just kind of kept nagging at me. And it was the fact that most women actually experience irritation as a result of shaving. But there was nothing out there where anyone just kind of said, well, maybe let's address that instead of just saying, like, you know, let's just keep putting out nicer versions or, you know, 20 blades and 10 blades and all of that. Like, what if we just address that? And I felt that as a small business, as an entrepreneur, as an individual, that's actually where my opportunity was, because I had the time and I would put the effort into learning more about it before I even brought a product out.
It's interesting that at the time, though, so you have the big corporations making razors, and they have a lot of these, you know, plastic products that sell at CVS and all these different places, right? And then at the time, though, Dollar Shave Club and Harry's and maybe Bevel even were starting to roll out, right?
Right.
But they were very focused on men.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, why do you think it was such an overlooked area, even with startups getting involved in it?
Yeah. You know, I think that shaving, kind of just the men's market, is always perceived as leading the way. I think that it's just easier to launch, and not to say that launching any business is easy, and not taking anything away from those guys, but I think that it is easier to launch towards men because it's an easier conversation. It's sort of expected. You know, one of the things that we found in our process was that not only just the fact that the razor certainly required some education and required us to have many more conversations with our customers and get to know them, but also that the sort of political language around women shaving is one that perhaps it might be better approached by a company that's started by women.
Yeah, one of the things that I've heard often from my female friends is just that the women's shaving products are, first of all, more expensive, and second of all, oftentimes less good or less, I don't know how to describe it, but you described all this like innovation in quotes that's happening around men's razors, which mostly involves like how many blades can we add to this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so from what I could tell, a lot of women end up buying the men's products,
right?
To solve that need, just because it's either the same thing and it's cheaper, or it's better in some way. Does that comport with what you've seen out there on the market before you guys got involved?
In some ways, yeah. So one of the things is that, you know, many women have said, and probably the women that you've talked to about shaving, what you find is that men's blades are actually sharper. So you end up getting a closer shave. And unfortunately, a lot of the products that are made for women, you know, it's kind of like, well, let's make them as foolproof as possible, because, you know, heaven knows, we don't know if she can actually shave her legs without cutting it off. So
what you guys... And I say you guys, I've been told I shouldn't say you guys anymore, by the way. It's such a hard habit to break. You folks.
You folks.
You all. But also my, Caitlin, our amazing head of editorial who's put us together for this podcast, has a bit more of a Southern twang. So she's able to go with the y'all or the you all. I can't pull that off. So I need to evolve my way of speaking around this. In any case.
You're forgiven. It's okay.
Y'all have built a really beautiful razor that looks, you know, like a straight razor for men, but it's got this beautiful gold color. You've also, I think, have a few variations on that one. Mm-hmm. You've talked about designing it as an heirloom product, something that, you know, you could pass on. That's very different from the, you know, $10 or whatever, $7 plastic razor that you see on the shelves. What was your philosophy around that?
You know, I grew up watching my uncles actually shave with a safety razor. And as an adult woman, actually, that's one of the gifts that I normally would turn to for men in my life. Almost every, you know, like my uncles, cousins, and so on, like at some birthday or another, they received you know, an Art of Shaving package from me. And it was always like the place and the experience that I would turn to and say, you know, you need to up your game and this is how you would do it. And it was like, anytime I thought about it, it was always, it was something that was beautiful. It was well made. It felt amazing in your hands. It shaves really well. It's a wonderful experience in and of itself, just using it. And like you said, it was made to last. And that's where I found that big empty space was for women. And I just couldn't understand why we didn't have that. And so I took all of that, all of those components, the things that drove me to purchase men's razors for, you know, for my loved ones, and thought, well, how do I wrap this up in such a way that women can experience this every day? It's not something that you need to have someone purchase for you. You know, this just becomes an option for you, because there was nothing like that. There is no Art of Shaving for women.
Was the safety razor the first thing that you started designing, or were the creams and those products, which one came first?
Yeah.
It's like a chicken or the egg thing. You kind of have to have both to make it a compelling package, it seems like.
Yes. So while I was still working full time, I actually decided to beta test the idea. And that beta test lasted about 2 years, because we are bootstrapped. But I researched where razors are from. I ordered some samples and so on. I found an amazing manufacturer. And I said, oh my gosh, razors have to be the most intimidating, like making a razor has to be the most intimidating thing I've ever experienced. So I'm actually going to start from, you know, we're going to set this up almost like it was a store. And so I sourced some razors from a manufacturer out of Germany that made some wonderful razors. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to pull my experience from Estee Lauder here. Women love oils, feel amazing. One of the things we always complain about is that shaving leaves our skin feeling really dry, irritated. So I'm going to pair, you know, something that women know, even down to the type of pump that we used, was something that when a woman touches it, it feels very familiar in her hand, because it's the same type of pump that you would find on a face care product. And so I sort of put that in a little package with the safety razor, and we started selling that, and we A-B tested. We, you know, A-B tested pricing, just like a lot of different combinations to see what would appeal to our customers. And they came back and they said, you know, wow, we really loved it. And then I listened and I asked them, I said, well, what are the things that are actually a little bit harder for you? Like, what could we do better if we were to make our own razor? And they said, oh, you know, well, sometimes I do cut myself, or I have to be like super careful. And so what I started learning about from that experience and from that feedback was the aggression levels of different razors. And so, you know, we're fast forwarding a few years here, and I was able to take all of that feedback about the aggression level, about the length of the handle that feels best in a woman's hand, about the weight that feels like so substantial that she doesn't have to press any more into her skin so that she can try and get a close shave. And we paired all of that together, worked with an engineer, went out to Germany, worked with a really fantastic manufacturer out there that's been around for over a century. And that was how we actually built our razor.
Do you remember how many units you ordered in your first manufacturing run?
By that time, I had a little bit more leverage. Before that, no one would listen to me. But by that time, I was able to say, hey, you know, Vogue has written us up. Town and Country thinks we're amazing. Excuse me. Allure magazine, you know, like I had like all of these like press chops behind us. And I said, we can't afford to do that many, but, you know, maybe we could start with like 300 or something. And so, yeah, we did our first run. We launched that in November. We've actually just sold out of our second batch. And now we're trying to plan to keep up with the demand for it into the summer.
That's amazing. Can you describe a little bit about the process by which they're made? Is it completely made of machined parts, or how is it actually produced?
Yeah. So we worked really hard on even the the sort of crosshatch pattern that goes around the handle. That's called a knurling pattern. And so I literally like kind of scratched that out myself and translated it to an engineer until we got just the exact feel that we were looking for. Some knurling goes a little bit deeper. We wanted ours to have just enough grip, but not necessarily be that like really thick crosshatch pattern. So we achieved that. So it's like, it's a really wonderful grip in your hand, but it doesn't feel like, I even wanted to get down to like how it felt in terms of it feeling very feminine and very, almost like a seamless connection, with your hand. And then the length itself, we polled women on, customers who had actually bought our previous razors. We polled them on like, you know, how it fit in their hands and like the exact length, you know, that would kind of work for most women. That's how we kind of came up with the length of it as well. And I would say probably the most, important thing is the actual, the angle of the head, which is what determines how sensitive or aggressive the shave is. And so ours is actually really tight with very minimal blade exposure. And what that does, it still allows a wonderfully close shave. But when you think about women, they're shaving their legs, they're shaving their bikini area, they're shaving their underarms. It's like we shave so much more surface area than men. And we shave some very, very sensitive surface areas. Like I can't even tell you the conversations that I have sometimes in my inbox. And I'm like, okay, that's where you want to shave. Let's talk. Okay. and so, you know, that angle and that blade exposure is one of the biggest things that affects, you know, basically like when you shave, the ability for you to get a really good close shave that is not, the razor basically isn't sort of coming at your skin. It's just really sort of tightened inside.
I'm curious to hear a little more about the process of going to Germany and finding the right factory to build this, you know, talking to the people there, getting them actually sold on making this short run. What was that like?
Yeah. So I will tell you, when I got that yes, it came from a woman.
Interesting.
And I had been out to a number of other factories, just reached out before I, you know, before we, I booked tickets with my little minimal bank account. I was just like, huh, okay, let me just reach out, make some calls, send some emails and just see, you know, is anyone willing to help me build the first razor that is of this sort that's tailored to women? And I got a lot of people who were just like, yeah, no, we have razors like that here. How about one in pink? And I was just like, no, I didn't ask you for your pink version. You know, I asked if you would actually help me build one from scratch. When I found the manufacturers that we have now, the first thing she said was, my mother and I have been shaving like this for years. We've always wondered why American women insist on using plastic razors. And I was just like, okay, I think I found the right guys.
That's awesome. You mentioned that there was a funny story about getting to Germany in the first place. What, how did that come about?
So I think I had taken the leap to leave my full-time job at that point. And it was, it was like a few months, you know, after or something. And, my fiance he's not a partner in the business, but he may as well be because he's incredibly helpful and kind of just drops everything to help me out. And I said, all right, you know, I'm going to do this. I'm going to go to Germany. I said, I feel in my bones that these are the right people for me to work with. And he's like, okay, if that's what you feel, let's book those tickets. And so, booked the flight, everything's great. We got to the airport and he goes to check in and they're like, you can't fly. He's like, what? So he had in order, I think we were flying into Amsterdam and then taking the train over to Germany. He had about, I think 30 days or something left on his passport. And the requirement is like 60 or 90 or something like that, more than he had. Wow. And so he's an entrepreneur as well. And so he pulled every entrepreneur trick in the book. He's like, okay, well, I'm just going to try and get this far and I'm going to talk to another person. I mean, he made it all the way to the gate where we were sitting pretty. And then suddenly his name, you know, they like announce his name over the PA system. And we looked at each other. We're like, damn. It's just like,
so he didn't make it?
He did not make it.
Oh,
he
made wow.
It. He had to, he actually ended up having to go to the passport office at 5 a.m. the next morning.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But he did end up making it. So we had the train tickets booked, I think like 2 days after we got there. So he basically spent 24 hours in transit. And then there was like a movie scenario where I am pulling up in a cab to the train station in Amsterdam, and he's pulling up in a cab to the train station in Amsterdam, coming from the airport, and we are booking it to the train and got there just as the doors closed and made it to Germany. I mean, we literally got to Germany sweating.
I don't know why, but maybe it's just something about how entrepreneurs work or something, but I feel like this always happens in the most important situations. Like, whenever you're making this like big life choice, that's when all these like weird things start to happen.
Yeah. I was on the train, and I literally said to him, I don't know if I should be doing this. And he's like, why? I said, everything that could go wrong has gone wrong. It's crazy. And he's like, but sometimes that's actually when you know that it's right. And I was like, whatever, I'm just going to take your word for it and keep going.
Now, why is it that Germany is such an important country in this industry? Is it the steel industry is so important, or how did it come about that all the great manufacturers of razors are in Germany?
Yeah, so it's razors, knives, swords.
That's true. Yeah, I think like Japan and Germany are like the two places I think of when I think of blades.
Exactly. Yes. And Japan was way too aggressive for what we needed to do in terms of the type of blades that they manufacture. And so Germany was the choice. They had the incredible history. Germany in and of itself, in the particular area where our blades are made, they have been doing it since medieval times, you know, starting with swords. They're known for their blacksmiths. And then as tastes and preferences and just time progressed, they also became known for creating really fantastic blades.
Yeah, I remember talking to Mike McAdan. It was one of the very first episodes of Well Made. It's probably in the first five episodes. And he was building some leather products and went to Italy and learned from people there who've been doing, you know, leather bags and leather products for centuries and centuries. And it seems like whatever the product that you're getting into, there's a place in the world or maybe a couple where people have been doing that for a really long time and built a wealth of knowledge. And it seems like a good idea to go see that and learn from those people, even if you're trying to take it in a completely new direction or trying to create that product for a new audience.
Yeah. You know, that's part of that is in my bones from fashion. I would never assume that me, you know, sitting here in Brooklyn, New York, you know, has more knowledge than anyone whose, you know, great grandfather started a company in a small town in Germany.
Speaking of Brooklyn, what was your journey from Guyana to Brooklyn? Tell me a little bit about growing up there and how you came to move to the U.S.
Yeah, so growing up in Guyana was incredible. It's like a traditional thing in Guyana. If your parents are immigrants to this country, normally what would happen is like the grandparents or so on would stay in Guyana and the parents would send the children back to be raised by them. And it did a multitude of things. One was that it allowed the parents to kind of get a little bit of footing in this country, whether they were, you know, trying to find work or whether they were going to school or whatever that process was for them. And it also allowed the kids to get a little bit of a grounding in their history and in their culture. So it served as both of those for my family. When I was just 2 months old, I actually went to Guyana. I was born in Brooklyn and went to Guyana to be raised by my grandmother and actually all of my uncles, which was really hilarious.
How many uncles are we talking about?
It was in total 3 of them.
Got it. Yeah. I was imagining like a dozen uncles for no, for some reason.
It felt like that though. It definitely felt like that. So yeah, you know, there's like the, what is it? Three men and a baby or something like that. That was exactly my upbringing. Yeah. So I just had like these three awesome uncles that were kind of like my dads, and they completely doted on me.
Did you have any siblings?
I have one older sister. Yeah. And she was already in Guyana as well when I went there.
Wow.
Yeah. So I grew up with this really incredible sense of culture that almost seemed to have no boundaries. You know, it was like, you know, as I mentioned, we, like, parrots were down the street, we had cows walking in the middle of the street, cobblestone streets. My grandmother was Catholic and went to church every Sunday and definitely tried to take as many of us along as she possibly could. But then, in, you know, on the weekends, like, we were often at Hindu celebrations and so on. And so I just had this incredible experience and exposure to culture and the food that came along with that. I'm definitely still a foodie. But much of that experience just really grounded me and has so much to do with how I experience the world. So, of course, you know, I was like, oh, yeah, my uncle shaved with this really cool stuff. That's awesome. And it's really funny that I would actually come back to that today after having seen it from so young and not even realizing that it registered. But I think it also led a bit to how I build a business. You know, I've always been incredibly scrappy, you know, just willing to get my hands dirty, travel wherever I needed to do whatever I needed to do in order to pull it together, including bootstrap.
Yeah.
And I credit that to that sort of cross-continental, you know, raised in a third world country in a sense, and then also coming over to the US and seeing that from the eyes of an immigrant. You know, I call myself like a backwards immigrant because I am a US citizen, but I came over to the US from almost in the sense of an immigrant, and then seeing my parents kind of try to do their thing as well while we were in Brooklyn.
How old were you when you moved back?
I was about 7.
Got it. Yeah, that's a fascinating. I have a weirdly different but also somewhat similar. My mother's American, and so I've had US citizenship since I was born, but I was actually born in Paris, in France, and grew up there.
Ah.
And it was funny because when I started going to middle school, I went to this international school that was filled with all kinds of international people from different backgrounds. Who I was the most boring kid because French and American was sort of normal, but I had lots of friends who were, you know, one was half Finnish, half Moroccan, but she lived in Russia for a long time, and one of my best friends was half Australian, half Italian, but his stepmother was German. And so he spoke a bunch of languages. Everyone around me had all these different backgrounds. And I just loved the cross-pollination of it all. It's just really fascinating and gives you an appreciation for different people's perspectives on the world. And just feeding your brain with all of those different perspectives, I don't know, just allows you to pull from so many more inspirations when you're building a company, for instance.
Yeah, yeah. I sort of know how to think in a way that doesn't just begin and end with my experience. And I think that that's part of that has come from the way that I've moved throughout the world.
For me, sometimes I put my French hat on, my French brain on, and I'm like, this is because it's a very different perspective. And it's actually one of the reasons I moved away from France. But it's an interesting that, you know, there's certain cultural differences that it's kind of interesting to put that hat on. Do you ever do that with your Guyanese side?
Yes. That side is always there, always figuring it out. My mom, by the time I got here, back to the US, was pretty much a single mom. And so it was like single mom, you know, kid raised in Brooklyn. And I was like showing up at school and they're like, you know, we had this very refined part of us because my grandmother grew up in Guyana, and she had so much of that British aspect to her. So I came here knowing how to like sit straight, use a knife and fork. I was like super prim and proper. And every once in a while, I would drop this thick Guyanese accent. They were just like, nope, you cannot use that when you go out into the world. You know, no one's going to understand you. And so I've always kind of had to ride that line. I'm always Guyanese and American at the same time. And I'm a bit of a shapeshifter in that way. And excuse me, when it comes to being an entrepreneur, you know, the way that I have relied on it is to, I grew up going to these like giant open air markets, the kind of ones that you would see in like China, you know, Thailand and so on. And it was just like, no, if there is an opportunity in front of you, you figure out how to set up a stall and you gather whatever it is you have to sell and sell it. And I think that that's who I am now. It's just, you know, I figured out how to do it in a more refined way, but it's always me.
New York and Brooklyn, probably in particular, seem like the perfect place for that, because that's sort of the story of that place in a way as well. And, you know, bringing all these cultures together, and a lot of bootstrapping has happened there. What do you like about being there?
I love the energy, that same sense of like scrappiness, and that the, you know, brand building, aesthetically pleasing, refined side. Those are all things that coexist in Brooklyn, and they still do. There's something about it here where it will not let you forget its roots. You know, I live in a fancy high rise now with like, you know, all the bells and whistles and so on. But every day I walk home through Fulton Mall, which is in like an old area of Brooklyn where like, you know, immigrants have always set up stands to sell like shea butter and incense and all sorts of stuff. And it's just like, yes, I purposely take that direction every day because I'm like, I never want to forget that that's what it actually takes.
I think one of the things that's always challenging when you're bootstrapping is, and it's true, whatever type of business you're building, there's always like a grass is always greener type of feeling where you're like, ah, man, I wish I could do this or that. What are those things for you? Do you ever have that feeling where you think, you know, maybe if I raised money or if I built this business differently, these are some of the things I wish I could do? Or do you just not think that way?
No, I wish I didn't think that way. I think about how many more women I want to experience this. And I think about being able to just kind of shout from the rooftops a bit about what we do and how fantastic it is. You know, we have had customers email us and be like, you literally changed my life. You have changed the way I experience my skin. You have changed my experience with shaving. And it makes me want to be able to tell as many people as I can about that. And the way we're going now is definitely the more patient, slow and steady route that you kind of have to do when you're bootstrapped.
And is that an intentional choice on your part, or is it something where have you decided to not fundraise explicitly, or is that something that you consider doing in the future? How do you think about that?
Yeah, it is actually something that we'll do in the future. I'd say this year, actually. But what I wanted to do first and foremost was I really just wanted to prove that we had not just a product, but that we had a groundbreaking product, that we had a really incredible experience. And I think that by not raising, and it was a purposeful choice, by not raising, what I was able to do was focus steadfastly on my customers and focus on their experience and make sure it was really, really good. When we moved from our beta product into, you know, the rose gold razor that we released in November, I mean, I'm not going to lie. I sat there with like biting every ounce of nail that I had off of my finger because I was just like, holy crap, you know, we just spent a lot of money and I hope that we did it right. And it looks like we did. And so I just really wanted to make sure that we didn't get ahead of ourselves and just start telling everyone about it without having made sure that we had done a really, really good job.
I think that's a really, really smart approach. a lot of entrepreneurs get sort of starry-eyed when they see, you know, you're in an industry where a lot of fundraising has happened. We mentioned, you know, Dollar Shave Club and Harry's and some of these other companies have raised tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars. It's a weird, it's like a gravitational pull. You know, you see that and you're like, man, am I doing it wrong or something like that? Yeah. And it takes a lot of strength to focus the way that you have. And I know that from the people at Lumi who use your products, they're huge fans. And it doesn't really make sense to, you know, put fuel on the fire if there isn't a fire. So you have to kind of start with something. It sounds like you're getting there.
Thank you. Yeah. I know a lot of people who have raised capital, and I know a lot of people who are also like, don't do it. it was serious to me. It wasn't something where I just kind of was like, yeah, you know, I'll take some capital and kind of see if this works. I want to build, you know, razors and razor companies are some of the longest lasting companies in the world. And we want the 100-year brand. We want to be around for a very long time. We want to change the way women shave. We want to create razors that are passed on to daughters and sons. We want products that are exceptionally made. And I thought the best way to do that was to just double down, talk to our customers, and make sure we were doing it right first.
I'm really excited about that story and what you're building, because it's one of those things that it doesn't get enough attention when people do it the way you're doing it. So I'm glad we're talking about it. What are the things that we in the community of well-made listeners can help you with? What is your biggest challenge right now that you're trying to figure out?
Our biggest challenge as I sit here is actually keeping up with demand for product. So, you know, if there was anyone listening who, you know, kind of has been through that experience and, you know, has like any feedback or any hints or anything like that, you know, just like controlling inventory and figuring that out and projecting, as you grow, then I'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. That's one of the biggest challenges when you're bootstrapping, is that you have to use your own cash to order more inventory. And that can be a really challenging thing, especially, you know, for a product that's not just a super simple thing or that you can't make in large volumes. On the other hand, the thing that I see that I have experienced a little bit is with the creams and those types of products, those tend to be really scalable because you can make them in larger and larger batches without as much, it doesn't take as much precision work as making a razor, let's say. And my understanding is that you had started to learn how to make those products just because you were interested in making them for yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I did. I mean, if it's so funny to sometimes to really look back on the journey. So when I knew that I needed to move into just working for myself and leave my full-time job behind, I was getting on the train every day with two, sometimes three bags. And I'm talking the IKEA bags, the big blue ones that just expand like a small car. And I had them chock full of boxes that I would, you know, packages that I would take into work every morning after I had spent the night sort of like pouring oils and packaging orders and everything. And you know, that person that comes on the train with the bicycle. Uh-huh. I was that girl every morning at 9 o'clock on a packed train going into the city. Someone someday is going to listen to one of these and be like, I remember her. She took everyone out.
That's amazing. We haven't, I want to go even deeper on this aspect of your business for a sec here, which is the sort of complement to the razor.
Yeah.
I'm curious, you know, that's a whole different skill set. What was your approach to building that?
Yeah. So my approach was KISS. Keep it simple, stupid. You know, I knew that there were, and thank you, by the way, for bringing that back. I tend to get so excited about the razor and that journey that I'm always like, yeah, that's all we make. When I first launched, it was just about keeping it really, really simple. And it was like, okay, I'm going to take an oil, put it in a component packaging that women are familiar with. I'm going to do a blend of oils, you know, I kind of like studied up on it, and it was relatively simple. You know, I used all natural cold pressed vegetable oils. I used all natural steam distilled essential oils. I had been playing with this type of thing for many years. And I just, you know, did like a small and simple sort of concoction, tested it on myself and friends and family and so on. And everyone thought it was great, loved it. I shaved with it. I said, okay, this is great. So I just paired it together as a package and introduced it to our audience and to our customers for the purpose of two things. One, would women even be interested in this? And two, would they pay a much different and higher, obviously, price point than they had before for sort of, you know, like a pack of Bic razors or something like that from from Duane Reade. And that part of the business, actually, it's interesting because it's all been somehow, it really all has been scaling, you know, kind of in line with the razors, which is really fantastic. So once we got to that point where I was now looking at having the razors made for us by this German manufacturer, I said, okay, I think it's time for me to expand on what we can offer as like these components as well to the razor. And I found a little factory that's right out of New York. They, you know, have like a full lab, a chemist on board and everything. And his background is at like Revlon or something. And he said, I can take everything that you have and I can translate it into a saleable product. And then I took the knowledge that I had from Estee Lauder with regards to actually packaging products. And I had to pull that component in as well. And I'm not going to say there weren't a few bumps in the road there. There's a lot to figure out on like how to actually do these things well and a lot of tests and so on. But we have been scaling up on that too. And that's been really cool. Now we actually have a new lab that's out in Arizona, and they are helping us add some more skincare worthy kind of products that will work to solve some of the other problems that women have around shaving. So the thing is, just because we sell a razor and, you know, that particular woman may purchase it because she shaves, it doesn't mean that like she shaves every part of her body. A lot of women actually will wax in combination with shaving. And so sometimes the areas that you're waxing, they're prone to ingrown hairs and so on. And so what we want to do is create a line of products that actually, as thoughtfully as we've developed the razor and all of the other products, aim to help ease the irritation and everything that comes along with the hair removal that women have to go through.
Are you 100% e-commerce oriented at the moment? Or have you, because I know that with your previous business, you had worked with retailers as well.
Yeah. So we ran a few tests with retailers and we actually performed really well. So I think we went into Urban Outfitters last year and we had a 4-time sellout. And then we were picked up by some of the smaller but sort of mighty beauty retailers, independent beauty retailers in New York and California. What I've decided to do is actually just concentrate on direct consumer for now, even though we've performed well at retail, because we actually can't keep up.
Yeah.
I think what a lot of people maybe don't know about the distribution strategy, you know, when you're trying to do both, is that they both take a lot of work and a lot of resources. And right now, just being direct to consumer gives us the absolute most leverage that we can have as a brand, and that is to be in direct contact with our customers.
Yeah, I think we've had a few conversations about this with some journalists, namely Lauren Sherman, who was on the show a few episodes ago, and in front of the show, Richie Siegel, who you were on his podcast.
Yeah.
And both of them, you know, have talked about the fact that building a business that is more focused on wholesale versus a business that is more direct to consumer, the skills that you get good at are pretty radically different. You either get really good at selling to the end consumer, or you get really good at selling to the buyers, the people who work for the retailers. And so it's quite a different strategy, and balancing those two can be hard, especially for a small company. So it makes sense that you're for not only because you're running out of stock and you have plenty of customers who want to buy direct from you where you're going to get better margins, but also maybe that's another reason that you want to continue getting good at developing that direct relationship with your customers.
Yeah. And you know, the other thing I don't really buy into, you know, the whole like direct to consumer is the only way to go. I think it just depends on the brand. And I think it depends on, as you scale, having the resources to put towards those different endeavors. It takes a team for direct to consumer. It takes a team for wholesale/retail sales. But I think any healthy company has to look at least two of those channels for distribution. And so for us, you know, I would hope that in the future, I have a big dream of doing almost like a modern barbershop type style for women, you know, where they're able to experience the products in person too.
If you went back in time to the very beginning of WeShave, what would you tell yourself? Is there any piece of advice you wish you knew at that point?
I wish if I had the knowledge that I have now, I would probably have just worked harder to get this particular product out earlier. I would have gone back and called every number, banged down every door, and been like, listen, buddy, we are in high demand. Don't mess around.
Yeah, that's hard. That's good advice for your past self. This was amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your story. If people want to find out more about WeShave, they could go to weshave.com. That's OUI, as in we, the French word for yes. And they can find you on Twitter and other places. We'll put the links in the show notes. Is there anything else you want to send people to?
You know, we have a lot of fun on Instagram. So check us out on Instagram too. And I'm usually on there as well. So if you have any questions for me, that's where to reach me.
Remind me, how did you come up with WeShave, by the way?
Oh,
forgot to ask you that one.
I was on the train going into work one day. It was about 2 days after I had shaved with a little like two blade razor, like a cheap pack that I bought at Duane Reade. And I just had the worst razor burn. And I looked up and there was an ad from an unnamed, you know, direct-to-consumer men's shave brand. And I literally looked at it and was like, my razor burn was like, I had on pants because I couldn't even chill my legs in the springtime because my razor burn was just all over my legs. And I looked up and I just got really annoyed. And I said, what the F, man? We shave too. And I just started laughing because I was just like, I may have just come up with the brand name there. And the reason I changed it to OUI was not just because I'm fancy, but also because I really just wanted to create a sense of positivity around shaving for women.
I love it. Well, thank you so much. It's been really great to meet you, Karen. And I hope everyone gets to discover what you're building at WeShave.
Thank you. Thank you. It was great to be here.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, if you got something useful out of it, I would love to hear what that was. Consider writing a short review, could be just a sentence long, by going to iTunes and searching for Well Made. I want to hear it all. I want to hear good, bad. I want to hear your constructive criticisms. I am just trying to make this show as useful as possible for you. So tell us what you think. That is the very best way that you can support the show. Thanks, and see you next time.